Let's start with the verse from yesterday, and from the Samyutta Nikaya. He or she who is possessed of constant virtue. And so yesterday's Dhamma talk was just about this, about Sila, and has understanding or wisdom, and is concentrated. So to maintain the series, today's Dhamma talk will be about concentration, samadhi. And so who is concentrated, is strenuous and diligent as well, will for sure cross the flood so difficult to cross. Now, preparing this talk this afternoon, some of the meditators, actually quite a number of the meditators that came for interview this morning, came to mind. And a number amongst you have had some good progress, and a number of you have managed to overcome the difficult, unwholesome mental states in the form of the five hindrances, or the hindrance of sense desire, the hindrance of ill will, the hindrance of sloth and torpor, the hindrance of restlessness and remorse, and finally the hindrance of doubt. And usually what happens is that once a meditator has overcome these hindrances and is free from them, at least temporarily, then some wholesome mental states will arise, and soon after this, the first insight knowledge will then unfold. And intuitively, a meditator will understand one specific or certain specific points without revealing at this point what it is. And the fact that the hindrances are no longer active in the stream of consciousness has to do with what? Has to do with which mental factor? There you go. And indeed, it is by the power of concentration that these certain hindrances get suppressed. Now, when saying that they get suppressed, it doesn't mean that the hindrances would be or are uprooted from the stream of consciousness once forever. This is not the case. However, the hindrances on a temporary basis are suppressed, kept, they're kind of under locker. But later on in the practice, do these same hindrances arise again, and then of course the meditator again will have to face some difficulties. So, it's concentration that is suppressing these hindrances. And in order to attain Nibbana, we need wisdom. And in order to develop wisdom, we need concentration. And in order to develop the concentration, we need mindfulness. And these things, these three factors are connected with one another. So it says in, or there's a quote from the Digha Nikaya, from the Long Discourses of the Buddha, of Long Discourses, yes, which says, perfect wisdom arises through perfect concentration. And perfect release is the product of perfect wisdom. Likewise, it is stated that he or whose mind is concentrated sees things as they truly are. Now, this concentration occupies a central position in the training of a being, of a human being. It is preceded by the training in morality or in virtue, sila, or sila seka in the Pali language, and then the training in concentration is followed by the training in wisdom. And so the importance of sila has to do with the fact that by keeping the precepts, the mind will not be not be destabilized through unwholesome activities or unwholesome deeds, and thus stillness of the mind becomes possible. Now, when discussing one of the mental factors, it is always helpful to take a look at the Dhamma Sangani, which is the first of the Abhidhamma works. And it's a work that defines, by way of synonyms, most of the mental factors. And so it does also define concentration. Now, another word for concentration is one-pointedness. And this term is usually used in the context of the jhanas, of samatha meditation, calm meditation. So, this Dhamma Sangani defines one-pointedness or concentration in the following way, namely, as stability of mind. And so, occasionally in your own practice, check whether the mind is stable or not. If yes, then there's a good chance that concentration is present. Another synonym for concentration is steadfastness of mind. And so, similar to this, absorbed steadfastness of mind, and then unshakableness, and furthermore, non-distraction and imperturbability of the mind. And so then, of course, there's also the faculty of concentration, the power of concentration, and right concentration. So in different contexts, different terms are being used. So in the context of the Eightfold Noble Path, the Pali term is samadhi, which means right concentration. And among the controlling faculties, it is samadhi indriya. So, Pali expressions for concentration are the following. Samadhi, meaning concentration. Ekagata, meaning one-pointedness. Samatha, meaning calm. And then, sometimes also the term avijjipa is being used, and this refers to non-distractedness of the mind, which is a very specific characteristic of concentration. Now, the word samadhi can be etymologically derived from the first portion sam, and then and then the part a, and then the root da. And so this then means the state of being firmly fixed, or in other words, the fixing of the mind on an object. And in the middle-length discourses of the Buddha, the Majjhima Nikaya, there is set another definition, or there's a statement regarding this concentration. And the Buddha says, one-pointedness of mind, this is called concentration. So, one-pointedness and concentration are the same thing. Now, this concentration, just like all other wholesome mental factors, comes in different degrees. For a person who does not meditate, who does not develop the mind, concentration may be very weak. But for a person who does practice either samatha or vipassana, this concentration in the course of time will gradually get stronger and stronger. And according to where or in which context the concentration arises, and depending on how strong it is, it is then given different names. Now, this one-pointedness of mind in terms of the Abhidhamma is one of the seven universal factors. Sabbacitta sadharana in the Pali scriptural language, which means it is a mental factor that is common to all consciousness. Now, the implication here is that concentration arises not only in wholesome consciousness, but it can also arise in unwholesome consciousness. So in that sense, it's different from mindfulness that only arises in wholesome consciousness. Pardon me? Oh, the other six universals are contact, and then perception or feeling, feeling, and then perception, and then concentration is there, and then life faculty, and then manasikara, which is wise attention. I think I've got them all. So these are seven mental factors which always arise as a group, and in every consciousness, every moment of consciousness that arises in the stream of consciousness, these seven will be present. And and then as for other mental factors, sometimes there will be some others associated, let's say sometimes five others connected with this moment of consciousness, at other times 10 or 15, depending on the case. So the number of concomitant mental states, mental states that arise together with consciousness, this number can change, but the seven universals will always be there. Now, right concentration, samasamadhi, in the Pali language, is defined as the four meditative absorptions. So it's tantamount to the four jhanas. And so, in a wider sense, we can say that right concentration arises in association with karmically wholesome consciousness, whereas wrong concentration, in the Pali language known as Nicca Samadhi, arises in connection with karmically unwholesome consciousness, so Akusala consciousness. Different definitions exist for concentration. For instance, the Visuddhimagga in section 570 says that the unification of the mind is concentration. And so the unification of the mind on its object. And so unification means the coming together. And so the Vibhanga, as we've seen earlier on, defines this concentration as steadfastness of the mind. Now, the Visuddhimagga goes on to define this mental factor in the usual or classical fourfold manner, namely by giving its characteristic, its function, its manifestation, and approximate cause. So, the characteristic of concentration is non-distraction or non-wandering of the mind. So, all of you will be familiar from your own meditation practice with with a distracted state of mind. When you think back of your first few sitting sessions and walking sessions during this retreat, then you will have noticed that the mind is flitting here, flitting there, going into the future, going into the past, and so on. And hardly ever is it really with the presently arising object. But now, after a couple of days of practice, the situation has changed, and some amount of concentration is there. The mind is somehow unified. And so concentration will be there, plus plus other associated mental states, they'll all come together. There's a unification of the relevant mental states, and thus the mind as a whole becomes very powerful. So, and that's the function of concentration, namely that it leads to a conglomeration or a unification or uniting of the associated states of consciousness or associated mental states. Now, there is a nice station for a distracted state of mind and a concentrated state of mind. If you take one of these fluorescent lights here, or a candescent light, then its rays, its light rays, will do what? They'll shine into just one direction, or they'll shine everywhere, almost everywhere. So they'll go in many different directions. And this case of the fluorescent light, or the light rays of a fluorescent lamp, corresponds to a distracted state of mind. So the mind is going here, it's going there, and so the different mental factors are not working together. They're going in different directions. Whereas the illustration for a concentrated mind is that of a laser lamp. A laser lamp which bundles the different laser rays and then focuses them on a particular object. And such kind of a bundled laser light is very powerful. And you will know, in a similar sense, if you take a magnifying glass and you let the sun rays shine through it, then the magnifying glass will bundle these sun rays, and if you put a piece of paper underneath, a fire might start. So, same thing with concentration. Concentration bundles or unites the relevant associated mental factors. And as a result of this, the mind becomes quite certain and strong. Now, concentration manifests in the mind of a meditator as peace. And so, again, try to remember this. Apart from the steadfastness and the stability that we've mentioned early on, there's also this aspect of peace. And so if you find that there's peace in your mind, then this could be an indication for the arising of concentration, but not under all circumstances. And the proximate cause for the arising of concentration consists of two factors. So it could be either happiness, sukha in the Pali language, or it certainly could be a continuous wise attention. And the explanation for sukha is when you feel happy, when the mental state of happiness is present, then there will be a feeling of or state of well-being, mental well-being, plus oftentimes there will also be a physical state of well-being. And when there's this state of well-being, the mind is no longer distracted. So with a happy mind, it's easy to concentrate. But in the absence of happiness, let's say instead of happiness, there is restlessness or so, agitation of the mind, then it's going to be very difficult to concentrate. And so, as for continuous wise attention, the meaning of this is that if you keep directing your attention towards the development of concentration, then time and again, then concentration will gradually arise and gradually become stronger and stronger. Now, in our discussion of concentration, we have to distinguish two kinds of concentration, two broad categories. One is concentration arising in the context of the samatha practice, or otherwise practice of calm. And so this concerns the jhanas, the absorptions. And then, on the other hand, there is concentration arising in the context of vipassana meditation. And this kind of concentration is known in Pali as Kanika Samadhi. There you go. Correct. And now let's look at the first type of concentration. Concentration in the context of the absorptions usually takes a conceptual object as object of observation. And what are the possible objects for the concentration? It could be a so-called colored disc, in the Pali language known as a kasina. So maybe something like this. And you prepare for yourself, you take a piece of paper or some cardboard, and you color it white or blue or red or green, and then you place it in front of you, and at first with eyes open you look at it, and then in the case of a white kasina, you repeat white kasina, and then eventually a counter image will arise in the mind. And then when you close the eyes, this counter image will be there. So you will see this white disc in your mind. Now, apart from the different kasinas or colored discs, there are a number of other objects that could be used in samatha meditation, such as a quality like loving kindness. So when we practice metta bhavana, mental development through metta, through loving kindness, then the object of our meditation becomes this state or this quality of loving kindness. And then we radiate loving kindness first to ourselves and then to others. And just like you're reciting or you're chanting every night. And so in this context too, concentration can arise. And this concentration in the metta practice can become quite powerful, and one can even reach the fourth jhana with this, out of five jhanas, using the Abhidhamma way of reckoning. And then there are other qualities that one could use as an object for the samatha practice, namely a virtue of the Buddha, any virtue that is mentioned in the text. Or one could meditate on a virtue of the Dhamma, or a virtue of the Sangha, or a virtue of liberality, and so on and so forth. So there is a total of 40 in Theravada Buddhism, a total of 40 such objects for the samatha practice. And with the help of the samatha practice, we first experience what is known as a preparatory concentration, parikamma, samadhi, in the Pali scriptural language. And this means a concentration that is not yet seeing the counter image. So it's still a relatively weak concentration, a concentration that is present at the very beginning of one's practice. Then, with some further practice, one's concentration is known or becomes stronger, and then is known as access or neighborhood concentration, upachara samadhi in the Pali language. And as mentioned earlier on, this is usually in a number of forms of samatha practice known or goes together with the arising of a counter image. So, like I mentioned earlier on, you see the white disc with eyes closed in your mind. However, this kind of concentration does not as yet qualify as real jhana concentration or absorption concentration. So it's not the first jhana as yet. And then if the meditator continues to practice, this concentration gradually gets stronger, and then it becomes so-called attainment concentration, apana samadhi in the Pali scriptural language. Now, different from this is the Vipassana practice, concentration in Vipassana. And in Vipassana, first of all, we do not use a conceptual object, but rather, and not just one single object, but rather we use different objects as they naturally arise in the body or the mind. So there's no need to create anything. There's no need to introduce any concepts into one's practice. So if, let's say, some hardness arises somewhere in the body, the hardness becomes the object of observation. And so and the hardness becomes the object of one's concentration. If once the hardness is gone and some warmth arises, then the warmth becomes the next object of the concentration. Or if some predominant mental state arises, such as, let's say, joy, well, then the joy becomes the object of concentration, and so on and so forth. So, and in the course of a sitting meditation or a walking session, the mind will go from one object, stay with it for a while, and then when it passes away, move on to the next object, observe this. When this second object passes away, then the mind will go on observing a third object. In each case, the mind will be concentrated on the respective object. And so, kanika samadhi, momentary concentration, refers to the fact that one's concentration, or the mindset is concentrated first on this first object for a couple of moments or a minute or two. Once this is gone, then another object arises. The mind concentrates on the second object, stays with it for a while. When this is gone, the mind focuses on another, on a third object, and gets concentrated or gets fixed to this third object. And so, the term momentary concentration, kanika samadhi, is somewhat misleading, and creates the expression a view or an understanding that there's just one moment of one single moment of concentration, but this is not correct. It's a series of moments of concentration by using different kinds of objects, and this series of moments of concentration added one after the other, or occurring in a sequence, one after the other, then the resulting concentration can become quite strong. Now, there are major differences between this concentration in, or between samatha practice and vipassana practice. Just to briefly mention this point. Samatha practice usually is meant for the development of concentration. And it's not bringing about any major forms of vipassana wisdom or insight knowledge. However, in the case of vipassana meditation, the aim is to develop wisdom. So vipassana meditation leads to the generation of wisdom. This in turn, or this implies the development of concentration. Without concentration, wisdom cannot arise. So in vipassana meditation, we have both the arising of concentration and wisdom. And it is with vipassana meditation that unwholesome mental states can be uprooted from the mind once and forever. However, with samatha meditation, you can practice the jhanas as much as you like, as many times as you like. You will not be able to eradicate any of the unwholesome mental states, excluding a combination of samatha and vipassana. So I'm speaking of just pure samatha. Now, when practicing meditate, when being on a retreat, and just like this, 10-day retreat, and practicing vipassana, it's important to develop this concentration. And it's important to assure that the concentration assumes or possesses certain qualities. And when we turn to the Patthisamida Magga, the path of discrimination, and then we find a list of 10 qualities that concentration should possess. And these 10 qualities are really helpful for a meditator. So I'll explain them one by one. The first one is the mind is not distracted, the Pali for this is vikita, by pursuing the past. So, as you know already from your own practice, when you're engaged in observing the rising and falling movement of the abdomen or a pain or so, and then your mind goes off into the past, will you be able to know the nature of the object or not? Will be difficult. There you go. Oh. Therefore, our ideal form of concentration should be one where the mind is not going into the past, where the mind is not distracted through going to into the past. Now, from this, we can derive the second point. Just as it is useful not to let the mind go into the past, so too it is useful not to let the mind go into the future. So, the Patthisamida Magga says the concentration should not be agitated, or the mind should not be agitated, kampita is the Pali term for this, by longing for the future. Now, oftentimes when we think of the future, and then this is in connection with a certain longing, wishing for some event or something to happen, or wishing to possess something in the future. So, when the mind is torn towards the future, and then it's no longer in the present moment, and thus it can no longer know the nature of the presently arising object. So this is pretty obvious. Furthermore, the mind should not be shrunk through lethargy. or, you know, to put it differently, indolence, or very simply, you know, put, laziness. The Pali for this is kusita. And you can imagine when you sit on your cushion and you're not really motivated and you're overcome by, you know, by laziness, how is certain concentration going to arise? You're not really, the mind is not really working with the object, and, you know, as a result of this, the mind cannot become unified. So this, you know, unwholesome mental state of lethargy is another obstacle to concentration. So ideally our concentration should be free from this, and instead concentration should arise together with, you know, with energy. And then comes a different constellation, namely a mind in which restlessness is there. Restlessness, or we could even add remorse. Now, this restlessness, udicca in the Pali language, goes together with, or brings about, agitation of the mind. And a restless mind can be compared to the surface of a pond, surface of water, that gets whipped up by the wind. So, and then when you want to look through it, you can't, if you want to look at the bottom of the pond to see what is there, you won't be able to see it clearly. And so, another illustration for this restless or agitated state of mind is a flag that is flapping in the wind. So, our concentration should not be agitated through restlessness. The mind should not be agitated through restlessness. Furthermore, yet another constellation. Concentration should not be overcome by lust, or in a different way of phrasing it, it should not be over inclined towards a particular object. So this again goes in the direction of longing, wishing, longing, and the mind likes a certain object, and thus it's reaching out for this object. It wants to grasp the object. Again, what we have here is an unwholesome mental state which pollutes the mind, and as a result of this weakens the concentration. So what you want ideally is concentration that is free from lust or any kind of longing. And so what is valid for, you know, for lust or greed is then also valid for anger. So your concentration should not be disinclined or overcome by ill will. Now, what is meant by disinclined? There's a certain object that you dislike, and as a result of this, the mind does not want to bother with it. It does not want to work with the object of observation. So it's disinclined to contemplate this object. So rather than grasping the object, it kind of turns away from it. And this state too, is not favorable for concentration. So ideally, what we need is a concentration that is free from this disinclined mind, or a mind that is overcome by ill will, or to put it again in different terms, a mind that is stubborn through anger. Then, Patisambhidamagga gives us the next quality of characteristic of concentration, that the two pairs of the controlling faculties, namely energy or effort and certain concentration being one pair, and the pair of faith and wisdom, that these two pairs should be well balanced. And if they're well balanced, then it's easy to work with the mind. And so then it's certainly going to be easy to, you know, to have good concentration. But if the mind at times experiences an imbalance, meaning that effort is in excess, then this will lead to restlessness. Or, yet in a different case, concentration is in excess. So the first pair is out of balance. When the concentration is in excess, then the, you know, the mind tends to, you know, be overcome by sloth and torpor. And so, likewise, for faith and wisdom, if faith is in excess, then it will lead to a gullible state of mind, and one simply believes just everything, just about everything that is being mentioned, and so one loses one's power of discretion. And in the case of excessive wisdom, well, the explanation given here is that it manifests as cunningness. So the intellectual part of the mind becomes stronger and more important than the wisdom part. And so as a result of this, one no longer sees the true nature of formations. So with a mind that's, or in which these two pairs of controlling faculties are well balanced, it's easy to concentrate, it's easy to work with. But if the controlling faculties, the two pairs, are not balanced, out of balance, then it's difficult to work. One is effort and concentration, and so the case of excessive effort leads to restlessness, and the case of excessive concentration leads to sloth and torpor, to sleepiness. Yeah? The energy and concentration. And instead of energy, you can also say effort. And not. And of course, there are other possibilities. We can, in the case of a lack of energy or effort, well, it will lead to sleepiness. And in the case of a lacking in concentration, this will lead to, what do you think? Lack of concentration leads to? Distractedness. There you go. Right. Now, the eighth characteristic that our concentration should certainly possess is that these faculties of the controlling faculties of faith, of effort, of mindfulness, of concentration and wisdom are or should be directed toward a single purpose, and namely the purpose of gaining nibbana and strengthening these certain factors. And if your purpose, if let's say you have a double purpose or a triple purpose in your meditation practice, and apart from attaining nibbana you also pursue maybe something else, then of course it's not going to be, the concentration will not be that strong. Now, the second last characteristic of concentration is that there should be enough energy, enough or sufficient energy to achieve the previous two characteristics, namely, one thing was the balance of the two pairs of controlling faculties, and the other one was that the controlling faculties, the five faculties, have a single purpose. Now, see, what happens in the meditation practice is, especially when you get into the higher insight knowledges, and you've practiced already for several weeks or even several months, then some meditators are, you know, figuratively speaking, running out of steam. They no longer have enough physical energy and mental energy to do the practice. And they, with this, they're lacking in energy, and as a result of this, they have a hard time balancing the two pairs of the controlling faculties. They have a hard time to be really focused on attaining nibbana. So this is a point that concerns the later portion of the meditation practice. And then, you know, finally, the tenth characteristic of concentration or should be that it is strengthened. It should be strengthened through repeated practice. So if you just keep, if you continue to make an effort towards the development of concentration, well, then your concentration gets stronger and stronger. Now, when you have difficulties in your practice and you're not really making headway, then consider checking your concentration, and consider checking whether your concentration fulfills these 10 characteristics that have been mentioned or not. If not, then try to make necessary adjustments. Now, with regard to the development of concentration, it's helpful to look, or to take a look at the at 11 ways to arouse concentration as mentioned by the commentaries in connection with the enlightenment factor of concentration. So, you know, as mentioned in one of the earlier Dhamma talks, there are the 7 enlightenment factors, and for all of these, there's several ways of arousing them. And so, in the case of concentration, the first way, as mentioned by the commentaries, to arouse concentration is cleanliness. By cleanliness is meant cleanliness of the immediate and one's immediate environment, or in immediate internal, sorry, precise expression is the internal base and the external base. And by internal base is meant the body, one's own body, that one keeps one's own body clean. So head hair, then cut, fingernails and toenails trimmed, and then one ensures that one has regular bowel movements, and one ensures that the body is clean by taking a shower regularly, and so on and so forth. Now, cleanliness goes one step further. It also covers the external base. And by external base is meant the immediate environment of a meditator. So the immediate environment of a meditator could be the area of one's cushion and the area around here in the hall, and furthermore, one's bed, the room one is staying in. So one should see to it that one's room is neat and tidy, and that things are not flying around. And the rationale behind this is, if you practice in an environment that is messy, then this will have an influence on the mind, and the mind also becomes messy and somewhat not neat and tidy. And this is one of the reasons, not the only, but one of the reasons, why most of the meditation centers place a lot of emphasis on cleanliness. Especially in Asian countries, if you go to some meditation center in Burma, then you will be impressed, usually impressed by the cleanliness there. And this is meant to support the practice of the meditators. The the second way of developing or arousing concentration is by way of a clear mental image. Now, this concerns the jhana practice. So, strictly speaking, it does not concern the vipassana practice. The third way to arouse certain concentration is by maintaining a balanced mind or balanced certain controlling faculties. And this point is exactly the same point that we've discussed already earlier on with regard to the qualities or characteristics of concentration. So there's no need to go into this again. Then sometimes it happens in the meditation practice when one has had some fantastic, some outstanding, extraordinary experience, that the mind becomes over-enthusiastic. So there's much elation there, there's excitement there, there's much interest in the practice. One is overflowing with energy and joy. Now, in this kind of a situation, it's important, if one wants to develop concentration, it's important to calm this over-enthusiastic mind. Because if the mind is over-enthusiastic, there's a certain amount of agitation that goes along with it, and with this it's difficult to focus, to be concentrated. Then, at other times, it may happen that your mind is discouraged. And it may be discouraged by the fact that you've been experiencing that you're here already for day 5 to 6, and you've been tackling the hindrances already for quite some time. You're not getting anywhere. The hindrances keep coming back again and again, and you feel like giving up. At this point, one needs to uplift the discouraged mind. So one needs to one needs to change the mind and make it somewhat more joyous. And this, for instance, is job of a meditation teacher during an interview. So when a meditation teacher sees a meditator coming to an interview with a sullen face, and then a teacher should give some encouragement, not necessarily by cracking jokes, but at least being somewhat inspiring. And then the sixth way of arousing and concentration is by cheering up the mind. A mind that is withered by pain. Now, as you all know by now, plenty of pains and aches and difficult physical sensations as well as mental states might arise arise in the meditation practice. And having to deal with these pains is not so easy. Now, usually what happens, if you're facing a pain, you're working with it, and the pain is really strong, and then sooner or later the mind kind of collapses, it shrinks, and the mind withdraws from the object. And so at this point, you need to cheer up your mind. You need to make your mind happy. And so would be the duty or the responsibility of a teacher. Or you could even do it yourself by maybe thinking of some pleasant or inspiring event. And maybe by recalling times in your meditation practice when things were going quite nicely. And then the seventh way of arousing concentration is through a continuous balanced awareness. Now, This concerns particularly the higher stages of insight. When you're getting towards or into the knowledge of reobservation of formations, and then the knowledge of equanimity about formations, Sankhopeka Jnana, the mind tends to be quite balanced. And one's awareness also tends to be balanced, the effort is also balanced. And so, at that point, it's relatively, it's easy to practice, and the practice kind of, happens by itself, automatically. Now, there are some meditators, at this point in the practice, who want to step on the gas. They say, it's going too slow, I don't have much time, the retreat will be over soon, so let's get going here. And thus, they increase their effort, even though things are going quite smoothly, and they are progressing in the practice, yet they want to progress faster. And so, they make more effort, and they try to change here and there, and this then breaks the balance, and so it destabilizes the mind, and with this the practice can take a great a nosedive. And so what is required is just a continuous and balanced effort. Another way of expressing this is what you need is an effortless effort. So, you're putting in your regular amount of effort, but not too much. Not in an excessive manner. Then, the eighth and ninth way of arousing concentration according to the commentaries is by avoiding distracted certain people and choosing friends who are focused or concentrated. And if you happen to be on a retreat with some person, an acquaintance, who is exceptionally restless, and the restlessness shows during the sittings, the person changes his or her posture every 5 minutes, and then not only this, gets up from the sitting meditation, goes outside, does 5 minutes of walking meditation, comes back into the hall, sits back down, and then, and then sits for 2 minutes, and then decides to lie down, and so on and so forth. Then you're sitting right next to this person, and then will you be pleased? Most likely not. And so you might also get restless. You might think, my goodness, what is this person doing? And so it is a good idea to stay away from such people. And so just physically by sitting somewhere where other quiet or focused meditators happen to sit. And association of focused friends, then this can have, this can be very inspirational. And when one sees a friend on the retreat, sitting still like a Buddha statue for 2 hours or 3 hours non-stop, then one might think, well, let me also try to achieve this feat. And as a result of this, one's practice may, not in all cases, may improve, and one's concentration might get stronger. Now, the second last way of arousing concentration, according to the commentaries, is to reflect on the peace of absorption. Now, this works only for people who have actually practiced the jhanas before, who are familiar with the jhanas, who've experienced the first, second, third, and let's say fourth jhana, or some of the jhanas. And so who know what it's like to be in a jhana, to know this piece of the jhanas. And once you know this, and you happen to be in your Vipassana practice, and then you remember this, you recollect this particular time in your previous meditation practice, and this then may have a calming effect on the mind, and with this you may find means and ways of focusing your mind, of concentrating your mind. Now, for those of you who have not done any samatha practice before, what you could do is simply recollect times of your vipassana practice where where peace was present in the mind, where concentration was there, and manifesting as peace in the mind, and the mind was really focused to an object and to the exclusion of most other objects. So when you think of this, or when you reflect on this particular state, or remember this particular state, this may give you an idea of how to, or this will give you the ideal situation, how the mind could be, and then you may find just the right ways to adjust the mind. Now, the last and 11th way of arousing concentration, according to the commentaries, is to incline the mind and towards the development of concentration. And this is not much different from the continuous wise attention towards the development of concentration. So if again and again, or if it's a primary concern of yours to strengthen your concentration, let's say you start at the beginning of the retreat with a rather distracted mind, and then you say, okay, hey, this is too much, let me really make a big effort to get more, or to become more concentrated. And then you use every single opportunity to be more concentrated. The result of this kind of an endeavor will be that your concentration becomes quite powerful. And so, these are the 11 ways, as mentioned in the commentaries. And so, maybe the only thing to add is just some practical ways to further develop concentration. And can you think of any ways to develop concentration apart from what has been mentioned so far, from your personal experience? Noble silence, yes. Noble silence, and not talking, and furthermore, we can say to practice in a peaceful environment, peaceful and quiet environment, whether nature, there you go, even though if there's too much nature and you have birds flying around all the time, this can also be distracting. And anything else? Yes, indeed. Yes, it's correct. And some meditators, in order to push the concentration a little bit, use earplugs. And earplugs do help. Indeed, they help. And so, with earplugs in the ears, the external sounds will be muffled to some extent, and thus the mind is less tempted to go off towards external sounds whenever they occur. And somehow or other, the focus of the mind then is more and more, goes more and more towards inward phenomena. So the external phenomena kind of they're at the periphery, barely noticed, and the internal ones become more predominant. Then there is there's another behavior, another way of inducing concentration, and this was mentioned pretty much at the outset of our retreat, and most and all of you are practicing it. So what is this? Is it practicing? Who knows? The food you're eating, in which sense? Good. Yeah, that's a valid point. Yes. What I had in mind is something else, namely the restraint of the senses. So, if you as a meditator, if you're really effect on this, if you give much emphasis to this restraint of the senses, and then and you no longer look around, and then after a while one gets into a state of absorption. One is kind of like in a soap bubble, inside of a soap bubble, hardly aware of what's going on around. And so that very much helps. Maybe one more practical point, way to develop this concentration would be to stay in your Vipassana practice with one predominant object for a longer period of time. Let's say you have a pain, and the pain is clear-cut, and you just stay with it, not just for 5 minutes, but for 10, 15, 20 minutes, or 30 minutes. This will surely develop your concentration. So staying with one object for a longer period of time without switching objects, and pain itself, because it tends to be a clear-cut object, very much helps to develop concentration. Of course, it's not easy to work with, but the results are there. Maybe one more point, and so I've mentioned it already in one of the previous Dhamma talks, longer sittings also tend to help to develop. Let me conclude today's Dhamma talk by wishing, may all of you be possessed of constant virtue, may you arouse and develop strong concentration, kanika samadhi, momentary concentration. May this lead to the arising of strong and powerful wisdom, and may you with this eventually cross the flood so difficult to cross. And this is it for today. Any questions, any comments? Yes, Baruch. Oh, you mean as a mental state?
Yeah, the mental, under what?
Attachment comes under greed, the mental factor of greed, loba. No? And so, attachment is one. Yes. Yeah, it's still, wait a minute. Yeah, it is. In terms of Abhidhamma terminology, we can clearly define this as or call this as lobha, greed. Greed, liking, wanting, grasping, and so on. And then we could take another thing. There is attachment and clinging. So, tanha and upadana. Clinging is the upadana. And the clinging is an intensified form of attachment. And attachment can occur with regard to just about anything or everything. Attachment can occur with regard to physical phenomena, with regard to feelings and perceptions, mental states and consciousness. Under what condition does detachment arise? Well, detachment we can say is pretty similar, if not the same, as equanimity. No? Equanimity or balance of mind, the equipoise or equilibrium of the mind. And detachment means that the mind is not, it's, as the term indicates, it's not attached, but the opposite of it. So it just observes an object, or it is with an object, without getting carried away by the object.
And under what
specialty? Oh, and this comes under the mental state of neutrality of mind, tatra majja tatta, in the Pali scripture language. And it's a wholesome mental state, and a different term, but in meaning the same thing, for this neutrality of mind is upeka, equanimity. Ah, the concept of emptiness. Yes, yes, yes. Yeah, good. Okay. Is a good question, and this emptiness does occupy a major place, for instance, in Mahayana Buddhism. Mahayana Buddhism in Tibetan Buddhism. Now, some people are of the opinion that this concept of emptiness exists only in Mahayana Buddhism and Tibetan Buddhism, and not necessarily in Theravada Buddhism, which is a wrong notion and a wrong conception. And from a Theravada point of view, emptiness is an aspect, it's one of the aspects of anatta, sunyata. No? And in the Vipassana practice, this aspect of emptiness does come up in different places in the practice. And I'll give you one example. In one particular insight knowledge, where a meditator mostly sees the dissolution of formations. No? So whatever object arises, or whatever object is there, it's seen as dissolving, dissolving, disappearing, disappearing, and so on. So the resultant impression from this then is, or this then leads to an understanding of, or into a state of emptiness. No? So for a while, for maybe a couple of hours or so, a meditator may say, and it felt like emptiness. You know? So that would be one case. Then this term sunyata or emptiness then can also be interpreted in it or seen in a different way, namely as empty of a self. So you look at a particular, you observe a particular object in your practice, and you find, there's nothing that resembles an ego or a self or a soul. You know? Yes, yes. No. So there's just the, the object, and that's all. Pardon me, you don't have? Yeah, right. Indeed.
What comes from? The object
itself.
I see a mental state.
Oh, well, an object arises because of conditions. No, whenever certain conditions are present, the particular object arises. No, so to give you a very simple explanation for this, let's say it's hot outside, and with temperatures going beyond 37, 38 degrees centigrade, and then the body starts perspiring. So the perspiration now doesn't take place, unless you're working very hard with a pain or so. But with the external temperature being very high, then naturally the perspiration arises. So certain condition is there. Yes. Does this answer your questions?
Because we can go further and say even to each condition of existence as well.
What you're aiming at is this. There are certain factors that lead to the arising of form or materiality, and so or phenomena. Sorry. And those are kamma, so the force of kamma, of past deeds, and then uttu, which is climate, and then ahara, which is food and or nutrition, and the last one is mind, consciousness, citta. These four factors cause the arising of a being. There will be conditions for consciousness to arise. Your previous moment of consciousness plus the associated mental factors will have an influence. And if you go back further back in time, then you'll get back to what is known as the so-called rebirth linking consciousness, Patisanicheta in the Pali scripture language. And this is one specific function of consciousness which marks the beginning of an existence, and all the karmic energy or potential from the previous existence is being passed on to this rebirth linking consciousness. And this rebirth linking consciousness then will pass on the karmic potential to the next moment of consciousness, and so on and so on and so forth. From the Theravada point of view, it's one continuous, it's a continuous series of one moment of consciousness after another. And this not only for one present existence, but for a series of existences. And this will go on until the person becomes, let's say, a stream enterer, and then there are only seven more existences to go, or until a person becomes an arahant, and that's then going to be the last existence. No. So, keep the karmic potential in mind. That certainly plays an important role. Okay. So, go ahead, answer your question. Shai?
I'm just going to bring up the theme regarding his question. Yeah. Like it's good, good. I need to be...
One last point. Just interest or so. The time, the aspect of time, or the concept of time in the meditation practice changes. And our perception of time may change a lot. And sometimes time seems to be going by very slowly, at other times very quickly. And then in the experience of Nibbana, there's no time whatsoever. So that falls away. Okay, now it's time to end our session here. And the next talk will be tomorrow.